about the Buddha's teachings. You know, he famously said, you know, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering is how it's usually said. You know, that when he set forth on his journey of spiritual inquiry, it was to find out two things. You know, why does suffering exist and how might it be brought to an end? So first, a little about this word dukkha. The literal root meaning of the term has to do with the hub and axle on a cart. You know, they used carts drawn by livestock back in his day. They didn't have sealed bearings. So it was just a wooden hub on a wooden axle. And they'd put animal grease in there to try to keep it lubricated. And seeing as how they were kind of short on paved roads, very often dust would get and grit and whatnot would get into the hub. And so the literal meaning of this word dukkha is distress, which is to say, what happens when you got a lot of grit in your hub, okay? And the hub and the axle are kind of grinding against each other. They're distressing against each other. So one way to think about it, and actually Thanissara Bhikkhu, who is a scholar of the Pali Canon teacher, he actually uses the word distress as his preferred English language translation of the word dukkha. Okay. So this feeling, this inner feeling that somehow or other something ain't right, you know. And the Buddha's, you know, again to the outside world, say, well, this is his Four Noble Truths, that, you know, the reality of the existence of distress or unsatisfactoriness or suffering, its causes, the fact that it's possible to bring it to an end, and the means of doing so. So the Buddha actually had at least four words for joy and only three for suffering. So he may not be as much of a downer as you thought. And he spoke of dukkha as taking three forms. The first form, in Pali, is called dukkha-dukkha. And it is the unsatisfactoriness that simply comes with being in a body. Okay. The fact that these bodies are subject to illness, they're subject to infirmity, they're subject to injury, you're being hurt. Okay. That we have a mind that's likewise capable of suffering, of experiencing afflictive emotions, like fear and sorrow, depression, anxiety, anger, right? Emotions that are unpleasant to experience. And oftentimes we express them in ways that makes us not a lot of fun to be around. Okay? So the kinds of suffering that simply come with being in, you know, nama rupa, being in the body, being that come with corporeal existence, in the world. Second form of suffering, or of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, the Buddha spoke of, was one having to do a viparinama dukkha, which is the one that comes with our hardwiring, dating back millions of years, our abilities to seek out the pleasant, avoid the unpleasant, and ignore everything else, attachment, aversion, and delusion. And we do that because, like all other sentient beings, we're hardwired to do that. It's how we survive. Okay. And yet, being in a constant state of seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, and blocking out everything else, in and of itself, is a form of unsatisfactoriness. The third form of dukkha is one that he calls sankhara dukkha. Okay. And earlier when I was talking about anatta, not self, the constituents, the ingredients that we go to whip up a batch of self, you know, they're one of those, the pulling together of those five aggregates, you know, or fabrications, the bringing together to make something. So ultimately, sankhara dukkha is the suffering that comes from fabricating things. And most importantly, the suffering that comes from constructing the self. And the reason that that is a source of suffering is because it creates a terrible sense of isolation and separation, being cut off from. Okay.
Lloyd, don't we have to do that though, just to manage our day to day?
Exactly. The way that, that I imagine the Buddha might think of, you know, if he was using today's terminology, is you're entirely correct. We navigate, you know, we all by one means or another managed to get here this evening. Either we walked or we took public transit or we took a car or whatever. And so it's very skillful to have some kind of a vehicle and to know how to use it, how to drive it. So for the purposes of, you know, satisfying our basic needs and doing so effectively and efficiently and whatnot, it can be really handy to have, to be able to construe, to construct the sense of self, okay? The problem, the Buddha might say, is that we kind of find ourselves stuck in sort of an evolutionary cul-de-sac. Because the mind has gotten so good at doing this that we sort of fooled ourselves into thinking that's who we are. You know, this self that seeks sense gratification, that avoids the unpleasant, that blocks out everything else, okay. It's a very useful mechanism, right? It's a great thing for the mind to be able to do, to know how to do. The problem, says the Buddha, is that the mind has forgotten how to not do it. So what a lot of meditation practice is about is looking at what's going on inside the mind, what's happening, and the rate at which it's happening, and the better able we are to be able to recognize what's going on in the mind, then gradually, little bit by little bit, we get some insight into how to not do it. Okay. So what the mind has kind of got stuck in doing is this sort of compulsive self-creation. And we forgot where the off switch is. Okay. So I was doing some research a few years ago on the management of sacred sites on public lands. And there's this very famous crack climbing site in northeastern Wyoming called Devil's Tower. At least that's what President Roosevelt named it when he authorized it. It's also a sacred site for Plains Indian tribes. And so, and they hold their sun dances there in the month of June around the summer solstice. And what they've asked of the rock climbers is that they not climb Devil's Tower while they're holding their sun dance services. The vast majority of climbers honor their requests, some don't. So I was writing a book that had this, you know, the story of this place and the conflict over its management as one of the chapters. And I was interviewing climbers who were there at Devil's Tower and about their experiences going up on the rock. And one of them said, well, you know, probably the most difficult thing that I've done in my climbing experience is to climb a certain route on Devil's Tower. And he said, the second most difficult thing I did was to not climb Devil's Tower. Because there's this real sense of accomplishment, you know, and internal reward, being seen as an expert climber, you know, it's a really gratifying to the ego to undertake and complete an accomplishment like that. And then nearly as difficult, he said, was deciding to not do it, right? So the reason we call it practice is because for so long in our evolutionary history, the mind has just been focused on doing, you know, on performing these tasks, you know, to the point where we believe that's who we are. And what the Buddha is saying is that we've forgotten who we really are. And the purpose of meditation is to slow down this mental process, to really study the mechanism at work, really have a look at the means by which we construe self. Because once we understand how we're doing it, it makes it more possible that every once in a while we can not do it. And that when we can have the experience of not doing it, there's a huge sense of liberation, relief, and freedom, and joy that is released when that happens. And so that's why he said it's so important to try to gain some understanding of what these forms of suffering are. And because he said, that's where the freedom lies. That's what I was looking for when I went in search of, you know, why we suffer, why we experience this, the unsatisfactory, why we feel distress, and then how it can be brought to an end. And he was really only talking about that third form. The first form, dukkha, which is just attendant upon being in the body. I heard a Dharma talk at a retreat summer before last, and we had several teachers from different traditions there, and one of them was this fairly highly revered Lama, who is a Tibetan Lama who's in the Bay Area right now. And in the Tibetan understanding of our existence, they talk about three bodies. One is the corporeal body, the physical body, you know. That in Tibetan lore they talk about as the fear body, the body that experiences fear, the body that experiences physical suffering. And then they talk about the rainbow body, which is a kind of a personal energy cloud or aura that is around us. And as you get deeper and more adept in meditation and visualization practice and whatnot, then you become, the consciousness becomes capable of inhabiting this sort of rainbow body rather than only being stuck in the physical one. And then the third body is the sort of the universal body of which we're all a part. And when he over time developed this terrible, extreme case of fibromyalgia and was experiencing horrible nerve pain that turned out not to be treatable by any means that any of the physicians that he knew were able to do a thing about. He said there was times that it felt like he was burning alive in his body. Sometimes the pain was so intense that it literally paralyzed him, made him unable to move, unable to speak. He said, you know, one of the problems with some of these ways of understanding, you know, the nature of mind and existence and whatnot, is that you get the sense, sometimes subtly, not so subtly, certainly in my tradition, that if you're experiencing these terrible pains, you know, that you need to simply place the consciousness in one of the other bodies, you know, place it, you know, move your consciousness to the rainbow body or to the mnemonic eye, up to the, you know, to the universal body. And basically he said, when you're experiencing the kind of pain that I was experiencing, that teaching's a real crock. Didn't quite use that word, but that's exactly what he meant. He said the nature of the physical body being what it is that it is possible, he said, because that's my recent experience of experiencing physical pain that is so excruciating, okay, that it simply makes it not possible to be anywhere else but to be with it. And you, every fiber of your being wants it to go away. And you do feel not only excruciating physical pain, you know, break a bone or, you know, have untreatable bone cancer that you can't, you know, that there's no pain treatment for, whatever. Not only can you have unimaginable physical pain, but you also, quite naturally, experience the aversion to the pain of wanting it to stop, of wanting it to go away. And he said, and if somehow you find yourself judging your practice to be wanting, you know, that somehow you're not being a good yogi or that you're not advanced enough or whatever, because this is a very advanced guy, a very realized being. He's saying, if you allow the mind to play that kind of trick on you, that only if I was a better yogi, only if I were more realized, then I wouldn't be experiencing this dukkha, you know. He said that in and of itself is yet another layer of dukkha. Judging yourself for not being able to get beyond your physical pain. And the same holds true for any of us, whether it's physical pain or depression or a tendency toward anger or just sort of an ambient feeling of sorrow or whatever for no reason that comes to mind. The idea that somehow or another, if we were better yogis, if we were more insightful practitioners of the Dharma, that somehow or another this suffering wouldn't be happening. He said, please, if you can, let that one go. This is somebody who sort of specializes in the cultivation of karuna, you know, sort of the Tibetan version of metta practice. And he said, you really need to respect what's going on at all these levels of existence, you know, if you buy into that. Well, that's why, you know, in the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo, the phrases that are read to somebody when they're dying. You know, that's why one of the stanzas in there, you know, if the person's dying anyway, he said, oh, nobly born, you who are the son or the daughter of the Buddha, remember who you are in these times of change. Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear. And rest in kindness and generosity of heart, you know, your own true nature. So that way of understanding things can be very beautiful and very helpful, especially, you know, when you're getting ready to move on, like as in out of this body. And yet at the same time, he's saying you really need to respect the fact that, you know, this fear body, as we call it, is sort of there for a reason. And it's worth honoring everything you experience rather than trying to step away from it. When I was a kid, and a little kid in the Baptist church, you know, there were these old folk hymns. That, you know, one is, I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world of woe, but there's no sickness, toil, or danger in that wide world of which I go. Another one, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, my treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. Then, of course, in the 1930s, Woody Guthrie wrote this song about that called There'll Be Pie in the Sky When You Die.
I was thinking just of that.
And that's all about coming back to the present moment, you know. If what is being experienced is dukkha, okay, then the noblest way we can be with it is to simply acknowledge that that's what's going on. Okay. And if we feel aversion to it, that's what's going on too, you know. And it's a natural enough phenomenon. As to the second kind of dukkha, you know, the kind associated with just that, you know, we're these sentient beings on the earth and we're seeking to fulfill basic needs and avoid threat and just, you know, blank out everything else. Just because that's how we were wired, right? And so we, you know, just like, you know, when they were trying to trip up Jesus into flipping off the Roman state so they could whack him, you know, and they, you know, and they asked him about how people who were, you know, being, living in a colony of Rome, being cruelly oppressed, you know, how they were to regard the Roman governor. And he says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. And so he's basically saying, when he teaches about the body, he says, don't hate the body, you know, just because it has these needs, you know, and it farts and smells bad and always wants to be fed. And, you know, he said, it's just, it's the hand we got dealt this time around, you know, being in a physical body. Honor it, take care of it, you know. And in the rules for how the monks and nuns ought to live together, there's all this stuff about, you know, there's elaborate rules for bathing and feeding yourself, and, you know, mindful ways to do just about everything. So it's not that any of that is bad. Where we kind of jump the track, he said, is that somewhere along the line, we're so intelligent, or, you know, we have such knowledge of the world, we've gotten so good at meeting those needs, that somehow or another, the mind, the consciousness has kind of gone into overdrive, you know, with all of its energy being devoted to those three things, you know, that it's gotten to the extreme that in and of itself is a powerful source of suffering. And, you know, he talks about the, just like you were saying, Andy, he talks about the utility of constructed self. Sometimes it comes in really handy, you know, driving home on an icy road, you know, or you find yourself in some circumstance where it's really important to be on your game as far as seeking out opportunities and correctly perceiving and responding appropriately to threats, okay? Really valuable, you know, and that if you're, you know, like Ram Dass says, you know, find a call God, don't, you know, just don't forget your zip code. And that it really is helpful if you're going to make this way in your way in this world to have a social security number and, you know, and some education and some means of taking care of things. He said, but what we've done is fooling ourselves into thinking that's who we are, when in fact, it's just a useful device. It's something that is really neat for the mind to be able to do. But he said the sadness comes from the fact that most of us don't know how to stop doing it. And that when we conjure a self, when we construct a self, what we do as a result is to cut ourselves off from everybody else and everything else. When I, again, back when I was a little kid in church, and we were studying Genesis in Sunday school, you know, and as I grew a little older, you know, I'd kind of read that story over and over again, and I'd hear it over and over again, and it started to feel to me like God had played this, some kind of cruel cosmic joke on Adam and Eve, you know. First he puts them in this really nice place, takes care of all their needs, but then, and makes them, you know, curious, gives them substantial mental capacities, and then tells them not to use them, you know. Said, there's this one kind of knowledge you're not supposed to have. Well, tell anybody, you know, oh no, don't go there, can't, well, then that's obviously what you gotta do. And so they blame it all on even the snake, you know, this, she became infected with evil and then took over the noble man and so forth. And good God, I mean, think about that one a while. and a lot of people have, actually, when they talk about, you know, the earthen-based religions and then the evolution of Judaism, Christianity, and whatnot, and off to the patriarchal races. But another way that I've thought about it is the process of individuation, you know, that somehow or another, how they really blew it was that rather than seeing themselves as being enmeshed in nature, being one with all beings, okay, that they saw themselves as individuated, as being apart from, as being separate. And later on in Genesis, God tells, you know, man, you know, I've given you dominion over all that you see, as if, you know, you could control it or own it or make it what you want it to be. But it grew out of this idea arising in their minds, oh, we are different from, we're not the same as, we're not intimately connected to everything else. We're separate from it. Moreover, he tells us we're above it, and our job is to kind of control it. Okay. And it seems to me kind of an interesting parallel, because the Buddha is saying we have this fantastic mental capacity. One thing that we use this mental capacity to do is to play kabuki theater with each other, you know, which is to pretend that we're something we're not. That, you know, it's like Robin Das talks about sometimes about how, you know, it's like when we were born, it's like we were put in these sort of spacesuits, and we walk around in our spacesuits, and every once in a while we see somebody, oh, it's you. That there's somebody in there, there's some kind of spirit in there that's not what appearances tell us it is. You know? So it's this notion that rather like Adam and Eve, when we conjure a self, we individuate, we see ourselves from being separate from each other as being separate from all creation. Okay. And therefore, in some ways, kind of imprisoned. You know, like when Rumi would talk about, all my life I've been striving, standing at the door, knocking, waiting for the hidden secrets for the door to open and the hidden secrets to be revealed to me. Finally the door swings open. I've been knocking from the inside. So it's like everything that we wanted to know, everything that we think we're striving for, okay, is basically a creation of our own, it's the weaving of our own cocoon. That's why the Buddha likened the self to an egg once, you know. It's really efficient vehicle, and it gets you to a certain point. And then in order for it to continue to grow or to continue to evolve, the egg has to break open. Another simile he used a lot was that of the snake. He said that, and it's actually kind of a revered animal in Eastern religions as opposed to the West. And he talks about snakes grow a skin to protect themselves from the earth that they crawl on. Okay, and at some point as they continue to grow, they have to shed that skin and grow a new one. And then he talks about the person following the Dharma said it's the same thing. You grow this protective skin to enable you to make your way around in the world. And then at some point, as you continue to grow, the skin itself becomes like a cage. You know, it becomes confining, and it becomes brittle, and it makes you unresilient, it makes you unable to continue to move and grow, and it needs to be shed. And so the Buddha actually likened spiritual growth and following the path over a lifetime to just that. Growing a skin and shedding it, growing a skin and shedding it, growing a skin and shedding it. So that we are continually rebirthing ourselves into a fresh state of consciousness that is not imbued with the sense of separation, that's not so imbued with the sense of I thou. Even though sometimes it's helpful or useful to be able to think in that way, it's equally important to realize that it's just a mode of thought, you know, that it's not ultimately who we are in any way, shape, or form. And that if we come to that insight or that realization, that understanding, and do practice for the purpose of allowing that insight to occasionally spontaneously arise, that's how we make this transit from self-created suffering to freedom from that very suffering that we've created. That's the shtick anyway. Let's talk about it. Questions or comments?
Trying to make sense out of this, just bear with me. So, for example, like in this culture, like being successful, becoming a gold medalist in Olympics or something like this, that people seeking out to be the best of the best. But I feel like that's the seeking out who you want to be and or what you want to be, whatever the accomplishment that you have, and then seems like creating a more like a dissatisfaction, because almost like if you want more, and then sometimes you can get what you want, and then also creating that discrepancy between what you want to be, the ideal condition, and then what you are actually capable of, the two different things, and that discrepancy, the bigger this discrepancy, seems like creating more dissatisfaction or suffering, or you just don't feel happy about it. Or even like, you know, going to work and you know you want to be promoted, but you're not, or I don't know. I just can't think of anything else. But I feel like this, you know, living this culture. Even like if you go to like exercise, let's say, and then you know you do something. I did gymnastics, by the way, so I just kind of give you an example. So you were working on some kind of move, and you want to achieve to get it, because this whatever the technique or skill, the set of skills, that seems to be very impossible. But if you get it, you know, you might get recognized. Oh yeah, tap on the shoulders, and oh, I could do this. And but of course, this seems to be very impossible. So more you know want it, if you're more seeking out more to achieve or some kind of achievement, seems to be a more, I don't know. There's this satisfactory experience.
Goes to the question of intention. There's a stanza in a Taoist text called the Xuangzi. Says, when an archer is shooting for nothing, he has all of his skill. If he is shooting for a brass buckle, he is already nervous. If he is shooting for a prize of gold, he is out of his mind, he sees two targets, and he becomes incapable of even hitting it. He said, his skill is not changed, but the prize divides him, you know. He thinks more about winning than about shooting, and the need to win robs him of power. So like practice of archery in Zen is about that. It's about, you know, if you're all hung up on whether you hit the bullseye and get the prize and are acknowledged as being the best, then that goal, like reification of the self, cuts you in half, right? But there's nothing wrong with, you know, with developing athletic prowess, you know, going to the gym and making yourself as healthy and strong as you can. But you're doing it in that case because you're honoring the body, like the Buddha said, taking care of yourself, you know. And so in Buddha Dharma, it all comes down to the reasons why we do what we do.
For the sake of doing it.
And if you're craving, you know, you said tanha, that's the Pali word, you know, in terms of origin of suffering, of craving and clinging. So if you're craving an identity or an ideal identity that's different than who you think yourself to be right now, then you've divided yourself in half. And so the practice of Buddha Dharma is about kind of healing that division, bringing yourself back to one.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yep.
Just wondering how impermanence, not self, and suffering, how they all fit together. What's the series all about?
The three characteristics. Okay.
Yeah. How do they relate to each other?
How they relate to each other is that the first two cause the third.
Right.
That's the short answer. You know, he when he speaks about the Dharma, the, you know, there are different translations of the word, the way or the truth or whatever. He's saying, or the facts of the matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
The facts of the matter are that the only constant is inconstant change. You know, everything is always in flux. Everything is always in motion. Okay. The another fact of the matter is that everything is insubstantial. Everything that we think of as solid or real or permanent isn't. It's always in a constant process of morphing from one thing to another, you know. That it is without substance, even though in the, you know, the subatomic physicists are basically telling us that, you know, that essentially what we are is baskets of light. we don't appear to each other to be that, but in fact we are, you know, when you get way, way down to the nitty-gritty. And those being what they are, so that's just how it is. That's the nature of things, that they are impermanent and that they are insubstantial. But we have a state of consciousness that is disturbed by those truths. Because it wants the things to not be like that, you know. It wants there to be permanence and constancy. We, you know, we want to, you know, seek pleasure, avoid pain, and live forever. You know, for nothing to ever change, for everything to always be solid and permanent, and it's not. And that really disturbs the construct itself. So he said, okay, well, there's not much you can do about the first two. What you can do about the third one is stop constructing the construct itself, you know, or at least don't take it so seriously. Just acknowledge that it's, yeah, it's something the mind does, and sometimes it comes in handy, and sometimes it's a real drag. And maybe I just need to learn to live with, you know, be at peace with that. And then gradually, you know, like a snake shedding its skin, we find more and more times in our life when the self just really isn't necessary. It's just something extra, you know, that we kind of like an appendix or something, and we keep cranking it out, but it's not really necessary for us to make our way in the world for the most part. You know, it can come in handy, it has its uses, but we don't know how to stop using it. And he said it's really helpful if we can start to learn how to let go of this small self.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, that's all I got. And it wasn't any fun trying to get here tonight. It probably won't be much more fun trying to get home. So maybe we'll just take the extra time to have a safe journey home. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Braving the cold. Don't like it.
There's never been a time when I haven't felt better by the end of our sitting together. Never.